This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Emergency, written and read by Neil Strauss, which is me. Copyright 2009 by Stately Plump Buck Mulligan, which is the company I started to keep the people in this book from suing me. Production and abridgment, copyright 2009 by HarperCollins Publishers, who probably should have hired James Earl Jones to do this. To Donald Booth, who died when a block of ice fell from a building and hit his head, and to all those who never saw it coming. Memento mori. There is no crime that a man will not commit to save himself. Tadeusz Marowski. Part 1. Orientation. Prologue. The time was 7:40 a.m. I reached for the phone. "Do you have your axe?" came the voice on the other end. It was Mad Dog. "Yes." "Is your axe sharp?" "No, but I can sharpen it while you're driving here." "How about your knife?" "Got it. Everything needs to be nice and sharp." "Fuck. I'm supposed to kill a goat today. And I couldn't even kill the fly in my room last night. Really. Sadly. I just put a drinking glass over it, covered the opening with a saucer, then set it free outside. I'm a victim of my own empathy. I wouldn't be too happy if someone squished me flat, so it seems cruel to do to another living thing. 15 minutes later, Mad Dog pulled up in a weathered blue Dodge Ram 3500 truck with skull and crossbones floor mats and a lone bumper sticker depicting a gun sight next to the words, "This is my peace symbol." The goat peered curiously at me from a beige dog cage in the back of the truck. It was much cuter than I'd expected. It had a wide smile, silky white fur, and a gentle disposition. I began to feel sick. Symptoms: dizziness, nausea, shortness of breath. I turned away. I didn't want to pet it, befriend it, name it, or grow attached to it in any way. If I did, there was no way I'd be able to go through with this. My girlfriend Katie, whom I brought along for moral support, felt the same way. "Oh my God, it just bought at me," she squealed in delight and horror. "I can't look. I'll fall in love." So much for moral support. "Is this wrong?" I asked Mad Dog as we drove into the forest in grim silence. "I need a moral justification for doing this." "This is the circle of life," he answered coldly, without sympathy. He was thin, with ropey muscles, a receding hairline, piercing blue eyes, and a brown handlebar mustache. His hat was emblazoned with the Revolutionary War slogan, "Don't tread on me," and his sleeveless t-shirt advertised his handmade knives. "Every steak you bought at Safeway started out looking like this," he continued. "If you need a rationalization, you're hungry, and you need to eat today. And if you want to eat, something has to die." Then he leaned forward, flipped on a stereo, and blasted AC/DC's Kicked in the Teeth. Unlike me, Mad Dog was a real man. He could chop wood, make fire, forge weapons, kill his own food, and defend himself with his bare hands. In other words, he could survive on his own, without Con Edison, without AT&T, without Exxon, without McDonald's, without Walmart, without 2.5 centuries of American civilization and industry. And that's exactly why I was with him right now, crossing a moral boundary from which there was no return. "Help me look for a good hanging tree," Mad Dog ordered, as he stopped at a clearing deep in the woods and turned off the engine. Every moment, this felt more and more like a mafia execution. In the distance, I saw a deer bound across a clearing and disappear into the forest. It was such a strong, beautiful, graceful animal. I didn't think I could ever shoot one, unless Mad Dog told me to. After finding the tree and throwing pigging string over a branch, we returned to the truck and stood at the rear bumper next to the goat cage. "This is your protein source," Mad Dog began his lecture. "Right along its neck is its carotid artery. You're going to straddle the goat, push your knife through from one side to the other, and cut out the throat. Then we're going to hang it, skin it, and butcher it. Symptoms: dizziness, nausea, shortness of breath, self-disgust, guilt. He let the goat out of the cage and put a leash around its neck. It walked up to me and nuzzled its head against my leg. Then it stepped away and peed and shat on the ground. "The more waste it passes now," Mad Dog said, "the better." This was when reality set in. I felt in that moment like I was going to hell. The goat was able to handle a leash. It waited until it was out of its cage to relieve itself. It was practically domesticated. I didn't have to kill it. I could always ask Mad Dog if I could just keep it as a pet. "Don't anthropomorphize your prey," Mad Dog barked when I confided this to him. "Most animals won't piss and shit where they lay down." "I've been trying not to get attached," I told him. "That's why I haven't given it a name." "I have," Katie blurted. "I named it Betty. B-E-T-T-I-E. "When did you do that?" When she fluttered her little eyes at me. That was the last thing I needed to hear. Symptoms, everything, nothing, complete and total panic. I wasn't sure I could go through with this. I was wearing an olive baseball cap, a matching army shirt, khaki cargo pants, and a gun belt with a Springfield Armory XD 9mm on one side and a 3-inch rat knife on the other. This wasn't me. Until a month ago, I'd rarely even worn cargo pants or baseball caps, let alone guns or knives. Why, I asked myself, was I about to do this? Because I wanted to survive. This is what people did for protein before there were farms and slaughterhouses and packing plants and refrigerated trucks and interstate highways and grocery stores and credit cards. I never thought the day would come when I'd have to make a backup plan. A brief confession. I've begun to look at the world through apocalypse eyes. It usually begins in airports. That's when I get the first portent of doom. I imagine explosions, sirens, walls blown apart, bodies ripped from life. Then, as I gaze out of the taxi window after arriving in a new city, I see people bustling around on their daily routine. Endless rows of office buildings and tenements teeming with activity. Thousands of automobiles rushing somewhere important. And it all seems so solid, so permanent, so unmovable, so absolutely necessary. But all it would take is one war, one riot, one dirty bomb, one natural disaster, one marauding army, one economic catastrophe, one vial containing one virus to bring it all smashing down. We've seen it happen in Hiroshima, in Dresden, in Bosnia, in Rwanda, in Baghdad, in Halabja, in New Orleans. Our society, which seems so sturdily built out of concrete and custom, is just a temporary resting place, a hotel our civilization checked into a couple hundred years ago and must one day check out of. It's an inevitability tourists can't help but realize when visiting Mayan ruins, Egyptian ruins, Roman ruins. How long will it be before someone is visiting American ruins? That's how the world looks through apocalypse eyes. You start filling in the blanks between a thriving city and a devastated one. You imagine how it could happen, what it would look like, and whether you and the people you love could escape. Of course, I don't want it to happen. Hopefully, it will never happen. But for the first time in my life, I feel there's a possibility it will. And that's enough to motivate me. To motivate me to save myself and my loved ones while there's still time. I don't want to be hiding in cellars, fighting old women for a scrap of bread, taking forced marches at gunpoint, dying of cholera in refugee camps, or anything else I've read about in history books. I want to be writing those history books on a beach far away from the mess that self-serving politicians, crooked CEOs, and committed madmen are making of the Western world. I want to be the one who gets away, the winner of the survival lottery. I didn't always think like this, but then again, I was naive. I belonged to the American generation that believed it was beyond history. Until this millennium, nothing bad had happened to us like it had to every generation before. Those who came of age in the first 20 years of the century had World War I. The next 20 years were marked by the Great Depression. The following 20 years began with World War II. The next generation inherited Vietnam. And then, from 1980 to the close of the century, nothing. Or at least no war, no national catastrophe, no defining event powerful enough to pull us outside our self-centered, solipsistic world, outside our preoccupation with ourselves and our financial and emotional well-being, outside our comfort zone. Of course, society wasn't perfect, but to many Americans, it felt like we were just a cure for AIDS, a solution to the drug problem, and an effective campaign against urban gang violence away from getting as close as possible. But then, swiftly and without warning, it happened. History happened to us. Terrorist attacks, natural disasters, domestic crackdowns, bank failures, economic collapse. I can't tell you the exact date along the way I lost faith in the system, because for me, there were several of them, each chronicled in the section that follows. And over the course of this gradual awakening, I decided to equip myself with the tools necessary to survive whatever politics and history threw at me next. Preparing myself for hard times has been an incredibly challenging task, because some people were born tough. I wasn't. My parents live on the 42nd floor of a 72-story building in Chicago. They didn't camp, hunt, farm, cook, or even fix things themselves. As for learning skills after leaving home, I spent most of my adult life as a music writer for the New York Times, so I can tell you anything you want to know about rock and hip-hop, but nothing about growing food, or building fires, or defending yourself. In fact, I've never even been in a fight in my life, though I have been mugged twice. In short, if the system ever did break down, the only useful skill I really had was the ability to write about it. Perhaps, at best, I could talk someone with practical knowledge into helping me out. Or maybe they'd just mug me. But that wouldn't happen anymore. Today I can draw a holstered pistol in 1.5 seconds, aim at a target 7 yards away, and shoot it twice in the heart. I can start a fire by rubbing two pieces of wood together. I can identify 700 types of footprints when tracking animals and humans. I can survive in the wild with nothing but a knife and the clothes on my back. I can find water in the desert, extract drinkable fluids from the ocean, deliver a baby, fly a plane, pick locks, hotwire cars, build homes, set traps, evade bounty hunters, treat a bullet wound, kill a man with my bare hands, and escape across the border with documents identifying me as the citizen of a small island republic. When the shit hits the fan, you're going to want to find me, and you'll want to be doing whatever I'm doing, because I've learned from the best. You can call me crazy if you want, or you can listen to the story of the 8 years it took to open my eyes, realize my country can't protect me, and do something about it. It just may save your life. Part 2. Four Steps. Only the gods can dwell forever with the sun. As for human beings, their days are numbered, and it is no more than blustery weather, no matter what they try to achieve. Gilgamesh, Tablet 2, 2100 BC. Step 1. December 31st, 1999. Lesson 1. Birthday clowns to avoid. You need to pick a group that won't kill you. The voice on the phone was that of Joe Thomas. A fellow New York Times reporter, she was on the cult and terrorism beat. She'd interviewed Timothy McVeigh after the Oklahoma City bombing, covered the Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland at the height of their reign of terror, and investigated the aftermath of David Koresh and his bloody last stand against the FBI in Waco. I had just volunteered to spend New Year's Eve 1999 with a death cult. It seemed like a good idea at the time. The newspaper was sending reporters to different locations to prepare a package of features on the millennial moment, and I wanted to take part in it. I envisioned a group of middle-aged men and women on a remote hillside, clasping hands and awaiting the apocalypse, and I wanted to see the look on their faces when the world didn't end at the stroke of midnight. I wanted to hear how they would rationalize it afterward. Back then, I had no idea that I'd ever feel unsafe in America or be preparing for disaster myself. We seemed to stand monolithic and invulnerable at the center of the political, cultural, and moral universe, unchallenged as the world's lone superpower. For all the headlines screaming doomsday and worldwide computer shutdown, no sane person really believed life was going to come to an end just because a calendar year was changing. We'd survived the last millennium well enough, but there were some very panicked people out there who truly didn't think we'd make it to January 1st. And those people, Joe warned, were not just likable kooks. I don't think anyone in New York knows how scary these groups are, she explained. A lot of them are nuts who stockpile guns, and most of them consider the media the enemy, especially the New York Times. She then gave concrete examples of just how dangerous these groups could be. One anti-government militia group in Sacramento had just been busted for planning to incinerate 2 12-million-gallon propane tanks to start a revolution for the new year, and a second group, calling itself the Southeastern States Alliance, had been caught 3 days earlier trying to blow up energy plants in Florida and Georgia. That's crazy, I thanked her for the advice. I'll definitely be careful with this. That didn't satisfy her. I don't know how old you are, she warned before hanging up, but however old you are, you're not ready to leave this world. Death isn't something we're born afraid of. It's something we learn to fear. According to studies, children have little conception of death up to age 5. From 5 to 8, they have a vague understanding of the finality of death. Only at 9 do they begin to understand that death is something that one day may happen to them. My awakening came at the age of 9, thanks to the copy of the Chicago Sun-Times that my parents left on the kitchen table every day. One morning, I glanced at the headline, and the words dead bodies caught my eye. I sat down and read the story. Dozens of bodies of young boys, many of them close to my age, had been found buried in a basement and yard in the northwest section of Chicago, my hometown. A birthday clown named John Wayne Gacy had tortured, molested, and killed them. From that day forward, I realized I was no longer the master of my own safety. It wasn't just climbing trees and running with scissors that could harm me. It was other people. Before making my decision about the millennium, I called a friend of Joe's at the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks cults and hate groups, and asked him to recommend a few relatively safe sects to celebrate with. There's a very anti-Semitic fascist group called the Society of St. Pius X in Kansas you may want to look into, suggested Mike Reynolds, one of the center's militia task force investigators. They're probably not going to do anything to you. Probably. Well, there's also William Cooper, who heads a militia group in Arizona. He's training them to go to war after New Year, when Satan is supposed to appear. Or you can try Tom Chittum, who's looking to start a race riot, which he calls Civil War II. Maybe that would be too dark for you. Then there are the black Hebrew Israelites in Chicago. Clearly, Mike didn't care if I survived the New Year. Despite the Oklahoma City bombing 5 years earlier, I had no idea there were so many networks actively trying to destroy America from within. Where reading about John Wayne Gacy had woken me up to the danger lone madmen posed to my safety, talking with Reynolds opened my eyes to the existence of organized groups of them. So in light of this information, I decided to narrow my search to more friendly, unarmed, cuddly doomsday groups. The next day, I began sending solicitous emails to various doomsdayers and survivalists, asking if I could spend a few hours with them as the year changed over. I promised to bring my own food, water, and emergency supplies, hoping that somehow this would convince them I was a believer. I soon discovered that one of the difficulties in writing about people who think the world is going to end is that they instantly know you don't believe them, because if you did, you'd know there wouldn't be anyone left the next day to read your article. The first person I contacted was Thomas Chase, a writer and theorist who predicted that the millennium bug would cause a massive electrical crash, triggering a worldwide depression and the coming of the Antichrist. I wondered what kind of sacred and meaningful ritual he'd be performing to prepare for the terror of the apocalypse. "I plan on going to Boston's first night celebration with my wife Peg," he responded. "I've usually gone every year for the last few years." "What about preparing for the end times?" "I did stock up on some extra water," he offered. The prospect of spending New Year's Eve on the Charles River, then going back to Chase's house to drink water with his wife, wasn't exactly Pulitzer Prize material. So I decided to call Jack Van Empe, a televangelist who'd been preaching the apocalypse since before it was trendy. He'd been warning viewers often on his show to prepare for the coming devastation of Y2K. But when I asked Reverend John R. Lang, the executive director of his ministry, what Van Empe was doing to prepare, he told me their leader planned to ring in the new year with Mrs. Van Empe and family at home watching television. After four more calls with similar results, the whole Y2K doomsday thing began to look like a big hoax. Perhaps it was just simple economics. With tabloid readers and journalists, including me, clamoring for people who thought the world was going to end on January 1st, 2000, scores of attention-hungry people arose to fulfill the demand. After all, something significant should happen to commemorate such a lovely round number. This was before the reality TV boom. There were fewer routes to national humiliation back then. So, in an act of desperation, I decided to ignore Joe Thomas's advice and contact the most dangerous group on the list. Lesson 2. Tips on Death Cult Etiquette. Despite having a rockabilly singer for a leader, the House of Yahweh was not a house to fuck with. An apocalyptic cult run by Yisrael Hawkins, known as Buffalo Bill in his rockabilly days, the House of Yahweh had received a lot of heat after Waco because of its similarities to the Branch Davidians. As a result, it was being watched closely by the FBI's anti-terrorist Y2K task force. Because its members are secretive to the point of paranoia, even posting armed guards around their 44-acre Texas compound, I dialed their bunker with some trepidation. "Hello, how may I help you?" a woman's melodious voice answered. I was taken aback. She seemed friendly. "Is this the House of Yahweh?" I asked. "It is," she said warmly, professionally. "What extension may I transfer you to?" She sounded like a law firm secretary. The only difference was, at this law firm, it would be impossible to look people up by their last names. They had all changed their family name to Hawkins in honor of their leader. "Do you have, like, a publicist?" I stammered. "Or maybe someone who sort of deals with the press?" "One moment," she sang into my ear. "Please hold for Shaul Hawkins." The great thing about real life is that it will always surprise you. Nothing ever turns out the way you expect. I suppose that's why I write nonfiction. If this were a movie, the organization would already have traced my number, bugged my phone, and kidnapped my brother. Instead, I was being transferred to the publicist and media relations executive for a death cult. "I'm doing a story for the New York Times," I told Shaw when he answered. "They're sending reporters to different places to, ring in the new year, and I wanted to see what you were doing." I'm the worst reporter, because I get nervous every time I talk to someone. Instead of sounding like a sharp, tough-minded journalist fighting for truth, I sounded like I was asking him out on a date. "Nothing out of the ordinary," he responded. I wasn't surprised anymore. He went on to explain that the group doesn't believe in the year 2000. They believe in the Torah and follow the Hebrew calendar, in which the year is 5760. The only thing happening in the compound on New Year's Eve, he said, would be their normal Friday Sabbath celebration. He sounded like a nice guy, normal, someone I could hang out with. But then he continued. They always seem to do that. "We do encourage people to store food, but not for the year 2000. After the Y2K fears don't pan out, everyone is going to think the world is okay. But in the book of Isaiah, it talks about the earth being burned and no one left. The only way this is going to happen is with nuclear weapons." All right, now I was getting somewhere. At least they thought the world was going to end. Maybe not on December 31st, but sometime. It's going to happen soon, he went on. And it's going to be over the 7-year agreement that took place on the White House lawn between Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat. In the news, Russia and China met and told the U.S. to stick its nose out of their business. It's a very small incident, but it could also lead to major upheavals and terrorist actions. Even Clinton was warning that we're facing biological and chemical warfare, and mentioned giving out gas masks. He paused for effect, then concluded, "There isn't going to be any warning." "That makes sense," I replied. Those words actually came out of my mouth. I'm a very empathic person. I tend to see a person's point of view easily, even if he's criminally insane. But it does seem to be a good way to make new friends, because moments later, Shaw was inviting me to join the group on a pilgrimage to Israel. "I'll see if the paper will let me," I said. "Why do I say these things?" I hung up and returned to my research. I had my heart set on a sleepover with a doomsday group. After all, New Year's Eve had always been anticlimactic. The year before, I'd been at a party in a studio apartment where I only knew one person. When midnight came, I just stood there like an idiot, weakly mouthing "Happy New Year" to anyone who accidentally made eye contact with me. So the year 2000 promised to be extra anticlimactic, unless I could find someone who wasn't just paying lip service to the apocalypse. The solution came in the form of a follower of Gary North, a Christian Reconstructionist and the Typhoid Mary of Y2K paranoia. Since 1998, after what he claimed were 4,000 hours of research, he'd been warning that when the clock struck midnight, power plants, which run on pre-programmed computer chips, supposedly unable to handle the changeover from 99 to 00, would shut down. This, he predicted, would lead to a domino effect of disasters and riots that could result in 2 billion deaths. Though North and one of his mentors, the survivalist pioneer Kurt Saxon, weren't speaking to the media, I learned that a group of their followers had built a self-sufficient community called Prayer Lake in the hills outside Huntsville, Arkansas. They believed that with faith alone, they would weather the coming devastation. They also stockpiled some food, water, and emergency supplies in case they ran out of faith. Unlike other survivalists, they didn't have guns or artillery. Rather than training to fight looters, they built additional homes and saved extra food to give potential robbers as a peace offering. Thanks to the miracle of directory assistance, I found a phone number for Bob Rutz, who had come up with the idea for Prayer Lake. I imagined sitting in Rutz's new house with his family, praying and waiting to see what happened at midnight. But of course, he had other plans. "There's a countrywide event at the local skating rink," he told me. "We'll be there skating, praying, and eating." Though Rutz was reluctant to talk to the press about Y2K for fear of being labeled a crazy, he spent the next half hour speaking with me about it anyway. "I believe it's going to be very bad, but I'm not going to be very worried about it," he said. "All I can do is have faith in God." President Clinton, Rutz believed, was planning to take complete control of the country by using the Y2K panic as an excuse to enact martial law. "So many simultaneous things are fixing to happen," he continued. "The Chinese have an agenda. The Iraqis want to wipe us off the map. The Russians have a use-it-or-lose-it mentality, and the Muslim terrorists want to destroy us. The other line of evidence I'm looking at is the amount of oil getting to your gas tank. I used to be an engineer for Fluor in the Persian Gulf, and I know those legacy computer systems. If we had 3 more years and a couple $1 million more, we still couldn't get ready. All you can do is get to know the Lord better." I thought Rutz might be the one. Sure, he was going to a skating rink in Huntsville, but at least I'd get some interesting conspiracy theory, a handful of scripture quotations, and a good headline like "The Last Skate." "If God tells you you should be with us, then you may," he finally said, relenting. "Come on over to the rink at 6 or 7 in the evening. We'll be together, whatever happens." He recommended a place to stay in town called the Phobos Motel. So I called and asked if they had any rooms available on December 31st. "When the rollover comes," the owner warned in a slow southern drawl, We're not responsible if the utilities go out. You can't get your money back or nothing like that. I asked if I should bring anything in case that happened. Well, he replied, taking his time with each syllable, I served in the Gulf War, and there's something my commanding officer told me that I will now tell you. A good soldier is always prepared. The next day, I set the afternoon aside to prepare. I didn't know of any survival supply stores in the neighborhood, so I went to a corner deli and bought a bag of beef jerky, a flashlight, and a bottle of water. Realistically, I doubted anything was going to happen, and even if it did, I knew Rutz had stocked up on extra provisions for looters. So all I had to do was start looting, and the treasure would be mine. However, there was one last item I knew I'd need to bolster my credibility with Rutz. So I went to a bookstore and bought a Bible. I still had 2 weeks until the new year, and despite my skepticism, the closer it approached, the more my heart tightened. In the late 90s, Western civilization appeared to have advanced beyond religious wars, beyond genocide, beyond imperialism, beyond borders. The Cold War had ended. The euro had been introduced. America was experiencing the longest economic boom in its history, and the internet and the mobile phone were turning the world into a neighborhood with few secrets. The political philosopher Francis Fukuyama captured the spirit of the time best in his 1989 essay, The End of History. What we are witnessing, he wrote, is not just the end of the Cold War or a passing of a particular period of post-war history, but the end of history as such. That is, the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government. We are a plot-oriented species, in perpetual need of satisfying conclusions to our stories. Even the Bible skips ahead to offer the book of Revelations as closure to Genesis. And so, one couldn't help but wonder, if we truly were at the end of history, then what was going to happen next in the story of our civilization, our species, our planet? How would we end? As Y2K drew closer, I began to get obsessed with those questions. When I talked to friends, all I could discuss was the millennium and what was going to happen. In my heart, I knew everything would be fine, but in my head, I imagined the worst. All the extremists I'd talked to were getting to me. I didn't know it at the time, but these were the first tremors of an earthquake that would eventually awaken the survivalist lying dormant in me, as well as in some of the most successful businessmen in the country, who would become unlikely allies in my obsessive quest. Perhaps we make fun of those we're most scared of becoming. Eventually, it became impossible for me to think beyond December 31st, to make any sort of plan after then, or even to write anything due after that date. I wanted to wait it out, skate with the survivalists, and hold my breath until the calendar year changed. Then I could exhale. But then, something unexpected happened. I received an invitation to the White House. Lesson 3. The use of philosophy as an excuse to cancel plans. I'd mainly known Bianca Gilchrist through her answering machine messages. They were short, shrill, and sharp. She was strictly business class. Her world revolved around her position and responsibilities as a publicist in the country music industry. So she'd call offering me an interview with Johnny Cash or Dolly Parton. And usually I'd take her up on those offers because I liked the people she worked with. I never would have guessed that each yes was to her a sign not just of a successful work call and a faithful execution of her responsibility to a client, but of a deepening connection to me, until, without even meeting me, she began to grow attracted to this black ink byline in the New York Times. Unfortunately, I had a rule never to sleep with anyone in the music business, not out of any personal morality, but because I'd failed in all my previous attempts, and it was just embarrassing. So 3 days before the millennium, Bianca called. Do you want to go to the White House with Trisha and me? By Trisha, she meant the country singer Trisha Yearwood, whose record label, MCA, she'd recently been hired to work at. When would that be exactly? I asked. For that Millennium concert at the Lincoln Memorial. There's a party at the White House after and all. She always talked like she was chewing gum between words. They're flying us there in a private jet. You don't need to write about it. Just come as Trisha's guest. It'll be fun. Shit. I'm supposed to go ice skating with some guys who think the world's going to end. Give me a day to figure things out, and I'll get right back to you. Okay, but you better hurry. I can invite anyone I want, you know. And so began 24 hours of mental agony, because each option appealed to a different part of my personality. My philosophy on life is that until I see it proven otherwise, I have only one to live. Even if there's a heaven, or there's reincarnation, or our energy exists forever, there's no telling whether our memories or our conscious mind will survive the trip. So I want to pack as much into this lifetime as I can. As big as the world is, I want to see it, do it, learn it, experience it all. As long as it doesn't hurt me too much, or others at all. And since I would only get to experience one millennial New Year's Eve in this lifetime, I needed to decide whether I wanted to spend it in the seat of American power in Washington, D.C., or the seat of American paranoia in Huntsville. Either way, if anything did happen, I couldn't imagine two safer places to be. In the end, I chose power over paranoia. The only complication was that, in the meantime, I'd realized Bianca wasn't inviting me because she wanted press coverage. She wanted me. Accepting her invitation meant making a prostitute of myself. And I didn't have a problem doing that. So I rented a tuxedo and filled my suitcase with the provisions I'd originally bought for Huntsville. Flashlight, granola bars, beef jerky, and of course, the Holy Bible. For some reason, I also packed a pair of binoculars. A good soldier is always prepared. On the morning of December 30th, Bianca picked me up and drove me to a private airstrip. She was short, heavyset, and slightly freckled, with stringy blonde hair. Like many in the industry, she had a brittleness to her, as if in order to succeed in a man's world, she had to sacrifice some of the softness and submission that serve as honey to men on a date, but as weakness in an office. We parked on the tarmac alongside the plane and walked on board with our bags to find Yearwood in a foul mood because her boyfriend, Garth Brooks, wasn't coming. When we arrived in D.C., a limousine picked us up at the airport, dropped our bags at the Madison Hotel, and then took us to rehearsal at the Lincoln Memorial, where an enormous stage had been erected. The main event was still a day away, and black-suited Secret Service men were already posted everywhere. Backstage, agents mingled with Luther Vandross, Tom Jones, Will Smith, Quincy Jones, Slash, and other celebrities. Several hundred feet above, sharpshooters perched atop the memorial aimed their weapons at us. Watching the elaborate security procedures, it seemed like there was little difference between the fringe lunatics and the men in power. Each was fueled by paranoia about the other. While the radicals bunkered up in fear of the government bunkered up in fear of the radicals. We're wondering right now if the Y2K bug has already hit, a White House employee told Yearwood. The security clearance cards we use weren't working today, and I heard the computers at one of the newspapers here crashed, and they had to lay it out by hand. I think that's a separate issue, a voice interrupted. I looked over to see John McCain, who was running at the time for the Republican nomination in the 2000 presidential election. He was trailed by an eager, just-out-of-college assistant. Easily ingratiating himself into the conversation, McCain seemed more cavalier about the millennium than any of us. However, he had played his own part in the panic, introducing a bill to restrict lawsuits against technology companies for Y2K problems. The longer the celebrities and politicians talked, the more they admitted their fears of losing phone reception, of being trapped in D.C., of being cut off from food and heat. Because they'd made no preparations, these mainstream role models, were actually more nervous about a millennial apocalypse than the sham prophets and cult members who had at least accepted their potential fate. Though few people know it, America was founded with the apocalypse in mind. Christopher Columbus wasn't just searching for gold or spices or a new trade route to Asia when he discovered the continent. He believed the world was about to end, and his mission was to save as many souls as he could before the clock ran out. In his letters to the King and Queen of Spain, soliciting funds for his next and final expedition, Columbus wrote that only 155 years remain of the 700 years in which the world must come to an end. According to his interpretation of biblical prophecy, his voyages to the New World were the first step toward the liberation of the Holy Land of Jerusalem from Muslim domination, which would be followed, he wrote, by the end of the religion of Muhammad and the coming of the Antichrist. So from the day it was discovered, North America was a portent of doom, a catalyst for a coming apocalyptic war pitting Christians against Muslims. 2 centuries later, John Winthrop led the Puritans to America, not just for religious freedom, but because he was running from a supposed apocalypse. In his case, he believed God was going to destroy England for its heresy. Thus, our founders were actually cut from the same cloth as zealots like Yisrael Hawkins and Bob Rutz. Even more disturbing, this zealotry remains the majority opinion in the country today. According to a recent CNN poll, 57% of Christians in America believe that the prophecies in the Book of Revelations will literally come true, and 1 in 5 of those believes it will happen in their lifetime. As I thought about America's unceasing obsession with fire and brimstone, I wandered out of the backstage area, awkward around the politicians, stars, and sycophants, to watch the stage crew. Several workers were in the process of hurling curses at an artificial sun that refused to illuminate. They'd evidently spent 3 weeks and $3 million in taxpayer money building it. On stage, Will Smith rehearsed the song he'd written to exploit the millennium. What's going to happen, don't nobody know. We'll see when the clock gets to 12:00. Chaos, the cops gonna block the street. Man, who the hell cares? Just don't stop the beat. The Secret Service, however, wanted to stop the beat. When I returned backstage, Yearwood was in a heated argument with several dark-suited men. She'd planned to open the show with a snippet of Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind, but they told her the song was inappropriate and refused to explain why. Later, I asked one of the show's producers about it. They thought the lyrics were a bomb reference, he explained. Only in Washington would a song that had been the anthem of the peace movement for 30 years be interpreted as a terrorist plot. The closer we moved toward the millennial moment, the more ridiculous people seemed to be getting. But this was politics, after all, and with great power comes great fear of losing it. Lesson 4, A Beginner's Guide to Evil in the 20th Century. The next morning was December 31st, the big day. I turned on the TV as soon as I awoke. Midnight had already passed uneventfully in Australia. I looked across the street to the Washington Post building, pulled out my binoculars, I knew they'd come in handy, and peered into the windows. There didn't seem to be any commotion. Everything, the streets, the hotel, the air, seemed quiet and still, reassuring, yet eerie. To kill time before the concert, Bianca and I went to the Holocaust Memorial Museum. Looking back on the man-made atrocities that had occurred just 55 years ago made the Y2K bug seem benign. All the predictions of the extremists paled in comparison to the concentration camps, mobile death squads, and bloody reprisals of the Nazis and their vision of a new world order. One of the most unsettling things about Adolf Hitler is that he wasn't necessarily an imperialist like Napoleon or Theodore Roosevelt. He wasn't just trying to subjugate other countries. His goal was to cleanse them, to wipe out the so-called weak races and speed the evolution of the human species through the propagation of the Aryan race. And for 7 years, he got away with it. Few of the most brutal periods in medieval history, from the sack of Rome to the early Inquisition, were as coldly barbaric as what happened in our supposedly enlightened, modern Western civilization. And though I left the museum with the reassuring message that the world stood up and said never again to genocide, it only took a minute of reflection to realize that it happened again, immediately. In the USSR, Stalin continued to deport, starve, and send to work camps millions of minorities. As the bloody years rolled on, genocides occurred in Bangladesh in 1971, Cambodia in 1975, Rwanda in 1994, and in Bosnia in the mid-1990s. All these genocides occurred in ordinary worlds where ordinary people went about ordinary business. The Jews were integrated into every aspect of the German social and professional strata before the Holocaust. The entire educated class in Cambodia, teachers, doctors, lawyers, anyone who simply wore glasses, was sent to death camps. And as Philip Gourevitch wrote in his book on the Rwanda massacre, neighbors hacked neighbors to death in their homes, and colleagues hacked colleagues to death in their workplaces. Doctors killed their patients, and school teachers killed their pupils. This sudden snapping of the social contract had always fascinated and terrified me, not just genocides, but also much smaller scale instances of group violence, such as the riots in the United States triggered by Martin Luther King's assassination, the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention, and the beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles. At its root, most people's fear of the millennium had less to do with the loss of electricity than with the snap that could follow if the system broke down. So what I ultimately learned at the Holocaust Museum was not never again, but again and again and again, maybe even tonight. After leaving the museum, Bianca and I met Tricia Yearwood in the hotel lobby to take special buses, which had been swept for bombs by the Secret Service, to the Lincoln Memorial. Police escorts raced us through the streets, lights flashing, sirens dopplering. When we arrived at the concert, we went through a battery of metal detectors, security questions, and bag searches. I wondered if the extremists had won, making us, the so-called normal people, just as paranoid as they were. "Under Clinton's seat," McCain's assistant told me, "there's a trap door and a staircase, which leads to a limousine that always has its engine on, in case there's trouble." McCain was assigned a seat directly behind Clinton, but rather than seeing this as a choice seat in the emergency exit aisle, his assistant feared it would be a Republican catastrophe. "I have to get him moved," he said. "If their photo is taken together, it could reflect badly on Senator McCain's campaign." This was why only the uptight, small-minded kids in school got involved in politics, I thought. It's not about changing the world. It's still about what lunch table you sit at. We shuffled to the green room to join the performers, politicians, and undercover agents. China had made it past midnight without a glitch, and in a celebration so beautiful, it seemed like the ruling culture of this next century would once more be the East. Other than the millennium clock shutting down in the Eiffel Tower, Europe was clear as well. Across the world, political situations seemed to be resolving. 155 hostages on an Indian air jet hijacked to Afghanistan were freed. Boris Yeltsin stepped down as Russia's president. The Nasdaq hit a record high. More good omens for a new millennium. I could feel a collective sigh of relief around me. It looked like we were going to be okay. Not just today, but forevermore. Compared to China's costumed and colorful blowout, America's Millennium Concert seemed bland and unfocused. At 11:45, as I stood in front of the stage, trying to think of something special to do for the great anticlimax, Bianca ran over with a plastic cup of champagne. "Trish wants us to join her backstage," she said. "She's supposed to sing America the Beautiful at 12:05. We rounded the scaffolding, showed our passes, and walked through the rigging to arrive stage right. Tricia, flanked by Quincy Jones and Kris Kristofferson, stretched out a boyfriendless hand and grimly accepted a cup from Bianca. Several men in black suits stood directly in front of us. I looked at their backs and noticed that just ahead of them, less than 20 feet away, President Clinton stood, waffling into the microphone. He was saying something about the unique responsibility we had to lead the world. The sun will always rise in America as long as each new generation lights the fire of freedom, he concluded. It sounded good, but really, when you think about it, what the fuck does that mean? Before any of us had time to think about it, the countdown began. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The lights didn't go out. The power didn't shut down. The world didn't end. Overhead, the artificial sun flickered and sputtered to life, much to the relief of many stagehands. We were all still here, shouting and hugging, engaged in the same annual ritual of forced festivity. Atop the Lincoln Memorial, I saw a line of Secret Service men with night vision goggles, aiming rifles into the crowd, and I remembered my pledge to avoid spending New Year's someplace with guns. I guess I'd broken my promise. I wondered what Bob Rutz and his band of psalm-quoting survivalists were thinking at their last skate. Had they wasted their time and money building their Arkansas compound? I was glad I hadn't fallen for the survivalist panic. For a moment, they'd almost had me scared. But at least I was in good company. Judging by the conversations I'd had here, they'd almost had everyone scared. When the concert ended, we boarded a bus to the White House. At various checkpoints, we were sniffed by dogs, our IDs and social security numbers were examined, and we were frisked by a blonde mustachioed man who was hopefully part of the White House security team and not just some random pervert. The first person we saw when we entered the building was Muhammad Ali, perhaps a perfect symbol for the decade to come, a former powerhouse battling a degenerative disease. Next to him, Martin Scorsese, Jack Nicholson, and Robert De Niro were talking in a huddle. To me, these were famous people, embodiments of the American dream. But to Bianca, emboldened by alcohol, they were bowling pins. She threw me against the wall, breath reeking of champagne, and drawled, "You're my guest, don't you run away from me." So I walked away. It was my first time in the White House, and the middle two floors of the building were almost completely open for guests to wander through. The first illegal act I committed was stealing a hand towel from the bathroom, solely because it had a presidential seal on it. In truth, the White House never held much mystique for me. The kids who were interested in politics, who formed the Young Republicans Club, who volunteered to work in local elections, were the boring ones. Powerless at the playground and parties, they were only able to feel self-important in a controlled environment like politics, with specific rules and prestigious titles. I know, because I was one of those uncool kids. I was in student council. I volunteered to staff polling places on election days. I even joined the Young Republicans Club. I didn't really know the difference between Democrats and Republicans. I just wanted to belong to something, and to bond with the slightly cooler, uncool kids I so self-respectlessly followed. As I listened to Barney Frank, the only openly gay congressman, urge a nearby gay couple to get on the dance floor to send a message to his fellow politicians, I felt a large claw grab my shoulder. "We're going home," Bianca hissed in my ear, upset that I'd slipped away from her. An hour later, we were back on the private plane, leaving as suddenly as we'd arrived. As everyone else tried to sleep, Bianca, more drunk and aggressive than I'd ever seen her, kept turning my swivel chair to face hers and talking dirty. "I want you to, you know, come in my face. I've never done that before. What does it taste like?" I told her it was kind of like eating lychee nuts. I'm not sure why that image came to mind. As the New Year's sun rose behind the plane, Bianca thrust across the seat, lowered her dress, and stuck her breast in my face. This, I thought, was an uncomfortable way to begin a new millennium. I just wanted to escape. When I finally made it home, I checked my email before going to sleep. There was a message from one of my new doomsdayer friends. "Hi, Neil Strauss, it's Tim Chase. This new President Putin in Russia? Interesting that he became the Russian president as the millennium changed. He could be the one, the Prince of Darkness." And I knew then that I'd made the right choice. There will only be one millennium party at the White House, but there will always be another apocalypse. Lesson 5. The magic of life. Now you see it, now you don't. When I was 12, I used to wonder if I would live to see the year 2000. It seemed so far away. I'd sit in class and count on my fingers, trying to calculate how old I would be. In my head, I'd beseech God, "Please don't kill me before the year 2000. I want to see what it's like." And he spared me. When I was 15, I used to wonder when I'd lose my virginity. I used to lie in bed, thinking about what it would be like to finally feel the naked flesh of a girl. And I'd beseech God, "Please don't kill me before I experience sex. I want to see what it's like."